You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Our unlived lives exert a powerful pull. The phantom of what might have been haunts us with the question, what if? Adam Phillips' new book, Missing Out, is a treatise on how we're shaped by these specters of our imagination. People rarely get back to the road not taken or re-encounter the one that got away. They remain mysteries, pristine and perhaps perfect, and continue to color our perceptions of the life we've actually lived. His book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Adam Phillips to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Why do you think this kind of past, what we in fact didn't do or experience, maintains such a persistent influence on us?
Well, I think one of the things that's striking is that not all our missed opportunities do haunt us. So in a way, the most interesting thing is what we're left with, what persists. What are the bits of unlived life that are so powerful? And I presume they haunt us because they carry something very, very important. They're like news from ourselves about what we might want. Even if not in literal terms, they're like pictures or bulletins about something about what we desire.
But don't some people actually return to those things later in their lives? People retire and they start painting or writing books or calling up
of course.
Loved ones from high school.
But in a way, that might be an answer, I think, in the sense that maybe these things haunt us because a part of ourselves keeps insisting that there are things we need to go back to, things we need to pick up again.
Well, is this because we know where the chosen path has led and we've experienced its disappointments and shortcomings while the other path remains pure and potentially perfect in its unused state?
I think that's true. And the risk is, of course, a nostalgia that is like a refuge. We can forever live in the lives in our minds that we never really lived. But I think the other truth in this is that, of course, no one can live all their possible lives, that it's inevitable that lives are sacrificed. That's just a fact of life.
And when does this process really begin? Is this something that we do throughout our lives, or is it more likely to start in middle age when we find ourselves in the life that we're likely to live for the rest of our lives?
I think it occurs at every transitional stage in different forms. So I think it happens in adolescence, I think it happens in middle age, and then it happens in sort of late old age quite often. That it's as though in those moments people are inevitably reconsidering where they are in their own kind of life cycle and what is inevitably or unavoidably sacrificed.
Do people tend to justify the choices that they've made?
If they can.
But then they also will often idealize the ones that they haven't.
Yes, I think that there's always a temptation to assume the unlived life would be better. But I think it could be a very misleading temptation.
Is part of the problem that every choice actually made limits your options to one and leaves multiple possibilities on the table? When you order a dish, for example, from the menu, you're refusing 10 or 12. After the fact, it's always clear that you should have had the duck instead.
Well, it's inevitable that even if you were able to choose everything on the menu, you would not in fact be able to eat it. So it's in a way a picture of this, of what we're talking about, which is the question is, can you enjoy the thing you've ordered? Now, you might think, oh, God, I should have everything. But were you to have everything, you probably wouldn't be able to enjoy very much of it.
Mm-hmm. So, but often people come to appreciate the thing. We see arranged marriages, for example, in the West. They strike us as odd. But when you speak to people who've been through arranged marriages, they'll often say, well, I wasn't sure at the beginning, but I came to love the person I married, or it came to at least accept it on some level.
I think there's a risk that we might be too good sometimes at adapting to things that don't suit us. And I think I agree with you, but I think the problem is that we might be more masochistic than we might want to be. And what I mean by that simply is that we find ways of getting pleasure from suffering. And once we do that, they become addictive. And so I think in a way people need to be awake to what they want and to what they've actually accommodated to that doesn't suit them.
Well, often when we talk about opportunities or missed opportunities, we ignore the fact that luck is a major element in any choice or arrangement we find ourselves in.
No, absolutely. I mean, our lives can hang on the people we happen to be in certain rooms with at a certain time. But given, I think, that at some level that's acknowledged, it makes our choices even more crucial. You know, in the one area of our lives where we can actually determine who we are, we need to take our chances.
In the case of me doing this radio show, I got a call from somebody many years ago. I've been doing the show for 28 years almost. March 5th will be my 28th anniversary. I got a call. The host of the show had died, and was I interested in trying out for it? Well, I was a bit ambivalent. I had other career opportunities at the time. I took it on a lark. For a couple of years, I was very unhappy here because the circumstances weren't all that great. And then one day I realized that I had this terrific job.
Yeah.
And then that became who I was from then on.
Yeah. But there could have been lots of moments in that story.
Well, I couldn't have gotten the call.
Where you were waylaid, exactly.
Or I could have quit and taken that job, another job that was offered to me.
And in a way, that could be one of the most interesting things about one's life, that there are all sorts of directions in which it can go, but they will only ultimately have been the direction in which it did go.
Is part of the problem that people aren't sure if they've made some of their choices themselves? They wonder if they went into law school because it was expected of them, or got married because it pleased their parents?
It must be important in everybody's life, the fact that there are people they wish to be loved by, to be admired by, to be respected by. But I think the risk is of thinking that there's a state of pure independence in which, as it were, we don't feel answerable or accountable to anybody. Because I think the question is both, who are we satisfying by doing this? Is it also us? And also, are those the people we do want to satisfy?
When we are talking about this topic, are we actually talking about wanting to be happy, whatever that means?
No, I think we're more talking about our relationship to frustration and actually what we do with frustration. Because I think part of the point of the book is to make the case for frustration, very unpromising, especially in this culture. But nevertheless, I think frustration is much more interesting and alluring and full of potential than it is usually regarded to be. There's a lot in it. When we're waiting, when we're in the process of waiting for something we want, we can imagine, we can think, we can feel things. I think that's really what it's about. And, of course, the lives we haven't lived are part of the life we're waiting for.
But are we living it in a different way as a phantom life?
I think we don't know, and I think that we're keeping our options open. And the risk is that in keeping our options open, we live neither one life nor the other.
What are some of the common fantasies about our phantom lives that we have?
Well, I think that they're a version of, in our fantasy lives, we'd be more transgressive, more brave, probably. We'd take more risks. We'd probably have more to lose, in a certain sense. The other version of this, I think, and this is, I think, very common, is that people have a very strong sense that if only their wife or their husband would change in a particular way, their lives would be fine. As though if only she or he would do X, everything else would follow.
But we also think that if we had taken that other road, it would have made us a different person.
Which it would have.
Are there fewer constraints on the imagined life?
There are definitely fewer constraints, but it's like a trial action. It's like we try it out in a place where there are fewer constraints. And then the question is, to what extent can we live it in the real world where there are so many more constraints? But there has to be fantasy before there's reality.
Isn't it true that frustration can shut you down, even paralyze you?
Yes, but if you wait to, I mean, it's think of the common experience. You're waiting for somebody you're looking forward to seeing. If you wait too long, when they arrive, you can't enjoy them. So we're all very familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But we can imagine, or I can imagine, a culture or a form of education in which we were taught something about that. Because the trouble is, we're left so enraged and so vengeful if we wait too long that we kill the very thing we want. And that's why I think, for example, frustration should be taught in schools.
Frustration 101?
Well, exactly. The children who know so much about frustration need languages and persuasive stories about frustration so they don't feel phobic of it.
My guest is Adam Phillips. He's a psychoanalyst and visiting professor in the English department at the University of York, author of many books. His most recent, Missing Out, in Praise of the Unlived Life. Well, I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations and which ended with somebody saying, woulda, coulda, shoulda. And we're all familiar with that.
Yeah.
So how do we get past that?
Well, I think we need to do two things. I think, first of all, we need to be able to enjoy that as a fact of our lives. I think that in a way, that we need to be able to both acknowledge that this is one of the things we do. We're the kind of creatures who imagine other lives. But I think what we really need to do is to be able to talk about them in a useful way. I mean, lots of people, modern people, for example, think, if only I'd had different parents, I would have been able to do X, Y, and Z. Well, this, of course, is the most ludicrous thought. The point is that those people really were one's parents. So the point is, what would my life be like if I hadn't had those parents? The point is, what can I make of the fact that I do have those parents?
Then I've had conversations with people say, you know, there was this house that was available to me. It was $20,000. If I'd bought it now, it'd be worth $1.5 million. But that $20,000 house was beyond that person's means at the time. So it really does. It's in an odd way, it's similar to not being able to choose your parents. You couldn't have had it. And yet you're still regretting the fact that you didn't buy the house.
Well, I think the presumably what we want to avoid is living a life of grudges or resentments. This is really all about...
accept frustration, but don't have a grudge.
Yeah, or find ways of being frustrated that don't lead you to revenge or to living in a grudge.
Well, you say that this inclination begins with the baby wanting the breast. So what happens? Often they get the breast.
Well, yes, but I think a lot happens in that process. If you imagine it, and this is... I'm sorry to talk in these psychotic cliches, but if you imagine a baby...
You are a shrink.
I am a shrink.
You're allowed.
Thanks. A baby's hungry. Let's imagine it like that. None of us know what babies think, but let's imagine it. Baby's hungry. It has a fantasy of what it desires. The question is, how long does that take to come? And if it takes too long, the child won't be able to eat. And if it takes too short a time, the child won't be able to imagine what it is that it wants. So I take that as a basic story about wanting.
And then the baby is learning about frustration from the start.
But yeah, I mean, frustration is the thing we know most about. There's no doubt. It's not that we need literally to be taught about it, but we need to find ways of being able to be shown what we already know.
And you write that frustration is always a temptation scene.
It's a temptation scene because we're tempted to fill it in with unsatisfying things. Because insofar as we're frightened of frustration, we try and avoid it. So I feel, let's say, a restless unease. I immediately have some chocolate. Or I go shopping, or I phone a friend, rather than being able to hold the moment and see and let it elaborate itself so I might get a sense of more exactly what I want.
You say in the book that addiction is unformulated frustration?
Yeah, because what's happened, I think, is that somebody has been in a state of wanting that has frightened them. They then found something to stave off the feeling of frustration. Then they've become addicted to the thing they found. So most I think probably all addictions are addictions to false solutions to wanting.
What about love stories? Are they all frustration stories?
Yeah, they're all frustration stories.
So what is it that King Lear asks of Cordelia, and why doesn't she just give it to him?
I think she doesn't give it to him because she can't, because she feels it's against the grain of their relationship, that it would be dishonest for her to say how much she loves him.
Even though she realizes that that's what he wants.
Yes, I think, I mean, the paradox...
I mean, he's kind of demanding it.
He is, exactly. And so the paradox of the play is that Lear is demanding something he shouldn't be demanding, and she's trying to show him that.
Well, that wasn't a very useful lesson for a long time. Are all stories about parents and children frustration stories?
Yeah, they're all frustration... Whatever else they are, they're all frustration stories, because as a parent, you have to frustrate your child, and all parents hate being hated by their children. So it's a hard thing.
So are you suggesting that we start teaching them about frustration from the start, actually have a little talk with them about
frustration? No, absolutely not. I think to begin with, we have to live it. The parents have to be unfrightened of frustrating their children and show the children that frustration is bearable. When children are a bit older and they are interested in plays and reading and all the stories, then we can tell stories.
What about the other side of this, fulfillment? I mean, we're not always frustrated.
No, but I think in a way that's the point for me, which is that only if we can let ourselves be frustrated properly will we find out what might fulfill us. The risk is that I don't let myself feel frustrated enough to work that out, because the book is on the side of more satisfying lives. But the book is saying you can't be satisfied unless you really know something about what you're frustrated of.
But also, many people have just made incredible sacrifices. And they will always be frustrated simply because a parent got was ill, or they lost a job, or they weren't accepted by the university that they hoped to go to, or they just didn't have enough money. They didn't have enough money to eat.
Yeah.
They fell in with the wrong crowd.
But let's imagine all those things happen to somebody. The risk would be that they end up feeling that actually life is terrible. Whereas those things could happen to you and you could still have some faith that there would be good things in the world.
Adam Phillips is my guest. Among his books are On Kissing, Tickling, and Being Bored. I guess that was also to some degree about frustration. Going Sane, Side Effects, and On Balance. He is also the co-author with the historian Barbara Taylor of On Kindness and with the critic Leo Bersani of Intimacies. He also collaborated with exhibition maker Judith Clark on the Concise Dictionary of Dress, and now Missing Out in Praise of the Unlived Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation. And by the way, if you want to write us and offer some of your own thoughts on this or give us a call, the number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or through Facebook, or you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at Leonard Lopate. Stay with us for more. We are back with Adam Phillips, his latest book, Missing Out, in Praise of the Unlived Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Did thinking about this book come out of your experiences as a psychoanalyst?
I think partly must have. I mean, in the sense that I was very struck by how much people talk about their unlived lives with a great deal of authority. You know, as though they know more about the lives they haven't led than the lives they're leading. And it struck me there was something very interesting about that fact, and also how much time was spent thinking about what one might, could, should have done.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you manage to maintain a faith in life in the face of continued frustration? I'm sure people talk to you about that all the time.
But you might think, in a way, I mean, that is the question we're all faced with. And I think there's a terror that people would lose heart. And this is why
some people do commit suicide.
And of course they do. And also a lot of people are much more unhappy than they want to be. Mm-hmm. And I think the point about this is that this is why people are phobic of frustration, is because they're very frightened of actually thinking and talking about how much they and what they might want and whether it's available. Because the one thing people don't talk about in this culture is scarcity, the fact there are limited resources. There really are limited resources. And so every life is going to involve a lot of frustration.
Aren't the resources growing? For example, what's happening when someone meets the person of his or her dreams? Now we have more options than we did in the past, don't we?
Well, it's hard to know whether there are more
options. Is Facebook a better way of meeting somebody than sitting next to this person at the bar?
Well, there's a logical point here, isn't there, which is if we get to meet more people, we have more chance of meeting Miss or Mr. Wright. It's a bit like, if I don't go to parties, I'll never meet anybody. But the other story is that romance is very, very unpredictable. And so it may not be a numbers game. It might not be about, as it were, meeting and interviewing 40 partners to find the one. It might be a good luck or a bad luck story.
What did Freud mean when he said the finding of an object is always the refinding of an object?
That we can only desire or be interested in somebody who reminds us enough of our parents so that we can actually notice them, but not too much of our parents so we can actually have sex with them.
Why is the evasion of frustration a catastrophe?
Because if we evade frustration, we'll have no idea what we want from other people. And if we have no idea of what we want from other people, we can't really have relationships with them.
But isn't a lot of our popular culture now dealing with the idea of letting go of attachments, implying that we don't seek satisfaction but just take life as it is?
Yes, and I think it's very, very frustrating and enraging for a lot of people. Because I think actually, because we're children for a very long time, there's something very fundamental about attachments and about something to do with not all good relationships have to be long-term relationships, but there is something about the value of long-term relationships. And clearly, maybe for more and more people, long-term relationships will be friendships rather than love relationships.
I think a lot of people are attracted to Buddhism because, in an odd way, it minimizes frustrations by telling us we should want less.
Well, you could see all great world religions as attempts, as attempted self-cures for this problem. So, for example, my life on Earth may be very frustrating, but the afterlife may be better. Or, can I find a way of escaping from my desires altogether, a life without desire? But one way or another, it's all trying to address the fundamental problem of children, which is, how do I deal with my frustration?
Why does the psychoanalyst Andre Green insist that we don't want to not get it?
I think what he means is that we're very frightened of discovering what our desires really are. Not all of them, but some of them. That our desires might be very transgressive, very urgent, and some of them might be violent.
So those people who... There's a case right now in New York of a man who talked about killing his wife, watching her bleed to death, and then cannibalizing her as well. He's claiming it's just fantasy. I think most people hearing about the story wonder whether he could have just kept it fantasy. But also, others may have those kinds of thoughts fleetingly, but they're not going to go on into a chat room and talk about it with other people who have similar fantasies.
No, but you could think that's precisely what psychoanalysis or psychotherapy was invented for. It's a place where somebody else is willing to bear and listen to whatever your fancies happen to be, with a view to modifying them or re-describing them so that they might be useful to you.
But then psychoanalysis often takes a long time because people resist. They may learn about what is going on inside them and then can't use that to change the way they act.
That's what
neuroses was.
No, that's absolutely right. But I think that if a psychoanalyst is going to be honest with the patient, the psychoanalyst has got to be very explicit that entering into psychoanalysis or psychotherapy is a risk, because nobody can know beforehand what they will end up saying, discovering, thinking and feeling. So it's a risk.
But aren't there pleasures in not getting it?
There are huge pleasures in not getting it, which is why there's a chapter in the book called On Not Getting It. Because actually what I'm trying to say there is that, you know, there is some importance in the fact that we were all once children, i.e. new people. And we spent hours and hours and hours listening to the adults speaking, getting a great deal of pleasure from it and having no idea what they were talking about.
Is there a time before getting it or not getting it is the issue? You talk about this concept in terms of Shakespeare's Othello.
I think there certainly was a time when it simply wasn't how we were thinking. And I think we recover some of this, for example, when we listen to music. When we listen to music, feelings are evoked in us that are way in excess of our capacity to talk about. So the intensity with which some people listen to music is quite overwhelming compared with what they actually can say about it. So when you listen to a piece of music or listen to a song or whatever, you're not thinking, am I getting it? You are having an experience. And you don't necessarily need to be able to say anything about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of almost feels like it permeates you.
Exactly, yeah. It's a bodily experience.
Which we can also get from other kinds of art, but in different
ways. And from each other.
In some cases, wordlessly. Music, obviously, can be wordless.
Yeah.
A painting or a sculpture. On the other hand, a book sets all sorts of other processes into action. A play sets other
processes. But also just...
But are they all pretty much doing the same thing?
Well, I think one of the things they all have in common is that something is exchanged between bodies that is more than the words that they exchange. So the people have a very powerful effect on each other as sort of physical creatures. And I think we're all the time trying to process that experience.
We have some listeners writing in. Our show page is at WNYC.org. And Jordan in Manhattan left a comment on our show page. She says, I have an ex-boyfriend who I thought I was going to be with forever, but now it's much easier for me to fantasize about life not lived with him because I end up keeping tabs on him on the internet. Has social media made these feelings of frustration about unlived lives even worse?
I think that it can give you the fantasy that you can keep track of people. I think it can give you the fantasy that you know what people are doing when they're not with you, whereas in fact you don't. You don't know what they're thinking and feeling.
Mm-hmm. But you do know whether they've met somebody else and they seem to be happy.
Yes, you do
or,
know.
Or you know that they haven't been happy and you can, may feel a little bit of schadenfreude.
Yes, I can see all that's possible. I think there might be a problem about having too much information.
Are there areas in our lives when not knowing gives us more life rather than more deadness?
Well, for example, if you read a poem, or indeed if you meet a new person, and your project is to know them, it seems to me it puts a great deal of strain on the relationship. You could just think, what's possible here? You know, what can we do together? Not how can we know each other. If you read a poem having to understand what it means, it could spoil your pleasure in the experience of the poem. And that's really what the book's promoting. The book's saying, of course there are pleasures of understanding, but understanding can preempt other pleasures that might matter more to you.
Is the nature of childhood, of growing up, trying to get it?
Well, I think ideally it's two things at once. It's trying to get it because no one wants to be left out. But what I'm proposing in the book is also we should be trying not to get it. In other words, we should allow ourselves to have the experience of not knowing where we are, not knowing what things mean.
And then there's another aspect to life about getting away with it. And there are some people who are much more involved with that than others, con men and such. But we all are to some degree. We all think about getting away with it on some level, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. And indeed, the chap says this. But I think what's interesting about getting away with it is that first of all, we get a huge amount of pleasure when we hear about people getting away with it. But in another part of our minds, we're also people who subscribe to the value of rules. So it's a bit like we're leading a double life inside ourselves. On the one hand, we believe people should be law-abiding, but we're thrilled when they get away with it. So the chapter says, well, what's going on?
Well, isn't there a sense of getting away with it that the powers that be don't want us to realize our power, our desires?
Or our power.
Yeah.
Yes, but I think that's true. But
that was a nice Freudian slip.
It was, yeah. But the other bit that's true, I think, is that it's not only a question of, as were the grown-ups prohibiting us. It's also a question of what's really possible about satisfaction.
Well, there are, I don't want to get into thinking about religion on a deeper level, but some people would suggest that God is a human construct. Can God get away with anything?
Well, I think the thing about God is, I mean, it's difficult to talk about this because obviously people believe in God in different ways. But if you believe God is a construct, one of the great things about God is that he represents somebody who by definition can never feel frustration. So at least we've got a picture in our minds of what it would be to never feel frustration. We've also got a picture of somebody who doesn't need to think about getting away with anything because he's running the show.
Well, when you get away with it, does it change the situation? Someone who commits a crime and gets away with it but still is considered an upstanding citizen?
Well, I think there's potentially something very dismaying about getting away with things. Because when
And is that an unlived life?
Well, it might be, but the bit of it that might matter here is that when you get away with something, on the one hand, you could feel thrilled and triumphant, but you could also feel quite marooned because what it proves to you is the law doesn't work, that nobody actually is keeping an eye on things. And so every time you get away with it, I think you're likely to feel both abandoned by the law or by God and possibly, at least temporarily, triumphant.
My guest is Adam Phillips. His latest book is Missing Out, In Praise of the Unlived Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Do the concepts of love, satisfaction, and desire look different after you've read Freud?
I think they really do, yes. I think they
In
do.
What ways?
Well, I think that, first of all, you have a sense of the origins of your desire in childhood. In other words, Freud plots a continuous story from the child who is hungry and needs to be cuddled and looked after to the sexually desiring adult. So one of the things you see is that sexuality is something that develops. The other thing you see differently, I think, is the way in which there's something about sexuality that promises more than it can ever give. That our, Freud says this quite explicitly, that our desire is way in excess of any object's capacity to satisfy it, which means that our wanting is always more than the world can deliver. So that Freud's got lots of stories, and of course he's not alone in this. Lots of people have got these stories, and lots of people writing at Freud's time. But Freud, I think, was trying to give us a sort of scientific account of why relations between the sexes, why appetite is so difficult.
So the unlived life in this case is you fantasize that this other person is going to give you things or supply you with certain things that you need, and then reality is that it's never really going to happen that way. There's another person involved in this equation.
Yes. No, that's certainly true. But I think the risk is, and it's a risk of psychoanalysis, that it's like a profession of killjoys. I think it should be acknowledged that people can make each other really feel fabulous. I mean, it's amazing how much pleasure people can give each other. But by the same token, they can, of course, really disappoint each other.
Now, I grew up in New York in an environment where everybody believed in the efficacy of psychotherapy. And then I went to school in England where nobody seemed to believe in it. You are a psychiatrist in England. So how do you explain to a very doubting populace the purpose of therapy? Does someone really get better, or is that even the goal?
Well, it is, but I think there are two goals. One is a pragmatic one, which is if somebody is suffering from something, you address that. There has to be a degree of problem solving. Very often, people come with something that is like a conversation opener. It's like a way of starting to talk about the things that matter most to you. So you may not get better, but you might have a conversation that has other side effects that really matter to you.
Well, just does knowing why you do certain things, figuring it out, does that in any way help you? Does it change the way you're going to act in the future? Theoretically it would, but there are some people who feel just so compelled. You may understand why you engage in criminal activity, Bernie Madoff, somebody like that, and still continue to do it.
But that, in a way, is a part of what the book's about, which is about the limits of understanding yourself. Because in a way, the book is against self-knowledge in a certain sense. But what does make a difference, I think,
self-defeating for a shrink to write a book like that?
We'll find out.
Okay, go ahead.
I think what does make a difference is somebody who is prepared to think about what you're thinking and feeling with you and talk to you about it, just that. But it makes unpredictable differences. But I think there's a basic feeling of solidarity that really matters a lot to people, that they don't feel completely isolated or completely crazy in their own minds.
Now, I get the feeling because I've cited Shakespeare a couple of times because you use him to illustrate your points, that Shakespeare, you may think Shakespeare was as great a psychologist as Freud.
Oh, better. I mean, the thing about Freud is one strong voice, if you happen to like this, in a much larger cultural conversation. But to only read Freud would be absurd. I mean, there are so many people one would rather read, but also there's so many people one could read as well.
Although Freud did write in rather wonderful prose.
He's one of the
more readable writers.
The only reason I'm interested in him, because he's a really good writer. It's a pleasure to read him.
Even though today people probably discount half of what he said.
But I think that's fine. I think only people who like Freud should read him. I don't think people should be defending him. I think it's just for people who like him.
Do you have concrete suggestions of the process of using frustration positively in your life? How should you think about it, and what should you do what should that allow you to do?
I think you shouldn't assume you can't bear it. I think you should feel freer to talk to people who feel are worth talking to about it. And I think you should experiment with, not, as it were, grabbing the first thing you want.
Do you think that the fact that so many of us are attracted to fiction is part of this whole story? Because those are we are suddenly, for a time anyway, transported into other people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a question of what we use literature for. It can be a relief from sociability and the difficulties of real relationships. It can also be a kind of wisdom literature. In other words, it teaches how to live. It gives us stories about what we might do with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful.
Well, but I think that anybody who's telling us how to live our lives in a work of fiction is writing lousy fiction.
Well, I think it varies. I think there are some writers who are secretly trying to create a cult and tell us how to live. There are other writers
who... And leads to Scientology.
But it could also lead to D.H. Lawrence. I mean, it cuts many ways, this. Because some people with very strong voices are interesting, even if we don't believe everything they say.
Adam Phillips will be in conversation with Andrew Miller at the Heyman Center for the Humanities at Columbia University tonight at 6:15. That's at 116th Street and Broadway. His book is Missing Out, In Praise of the Unlived Life, and it's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.